All right, good evening or good morning. I don't know. What time is it wherever you're at? Anytime is a good time for Michael Wizard time. All right. I want to dedicate this episode in particular to my homie running Mushroom Mundo on Instagram. We've been going back and forth over a few different things in the past year or so, and I find it very interesting that he drew this analogy the other day when I was sort of in this struggle bus mode of, trying to bridge a gap between gourmet cultivators and psychedelic cultivators. Because essentially, at the end of the day, it's identical aside from the phenotype. And, you know, I don't really have many issues with either side of the industry in particular, more along the lines of the demarcations that are set there. And something that he said was, you know, it comes down to something very simple. It's mainstream versus marginalization. And that is those two words like tied together, just they sum up this entire sort of split in the industry right now. You have so many people supplying like gourmet varieties on spawn or substrate or cultures to all the gourmet farms, and all the CVG cats selling psychedelic substrate to, you know, all the cultivators out there just doing cubes or, you know, whatever, all the other varieties of psilocybe species. And there happens to be like very little crossover aside from the obvious is like Norse Boar or, you know, even, I'm trying to think of the name of this. There's so many other places like Norse Boar that are like fulfilling these, you know, multi-leveled sort of farmer approaches to cultivating mushrooms, and including us, you know, we do CVG blends for people, in bulk, but we're quiet about it. And the legality is a rational reason to be careful. But then the other side to it is like, it is two very different types of cultivator. And I'm not shy saying that, you know, I've cultivated both types and I tend more towards the brain space of a gourmet producer. Whereas the psychedelic producers that I've spent a lot of time around, man, they're on a different fucking level. They're not on the same level necessarily. And is that an influence of psychedelics? I don't know. Is it an influence of having to, you know, be super covert and clandestine in your sort of operations? I don't know what it is. It's kind of fascinating at the end of the day. I don't know. There's so many different ways to attempt to bridge this gap, but it really doesn't come down to like just selling products for me personally. I think that the industry in due time is going to see many more farms, and there's plenty of them out there. Don't get me wrong. There's plenty of them out there that grow cubes and they grow normal mushrooms, you know, just gourmet medicinal varieties, even agaricus. So there really isn't a bridge to gap except for this like marginalization versus mainstream. So this is my attempt at doing it. This is the first podcast I'm going to release of quite a few that I've been recording. And this one is with Hamilton Morris. If you're not familiar with Hamilton's work, you should most certainly tune into what he's up to. His Patreon account is by far one of the best things throughout my, you know, weeks. Just the people he gets for interviews, the characters he tracks down, it's phenomenal. So when he was stoked to jump on Micah Wizards, I was stoked to have him. And we didn't talk about anything too deep or too far. We just talked about his history with mushrooms in particular. He's got this outsider perspective and fascination with Enigma. And, you know, there's so many other connective things that tie us together. But one of the interesting aspects of being in the industry and then outside of the industry is that I brought up the, like, you know, West Coast cubensis crash. And he was like, oh, that's a very good thing. You know, like this is how these things become affordable and accessible for individuals. And I was like, shit, I agree with that. But also trying to run a business with any sort of volatile ups and downs in terms of price points makes it very difficult for the decentralized, you know, small to medium sized cultivator to make any moves. You know, we saw Cubensis go from fucking $1,500 a pound down to like $70 a pound or less on the West Coast within a, you know, 2 year period. And it might have been a little longer than that, but truly the crash was fast, you know. This is not a habitual product like weed or something. So granted, it's going to be very different and take a very different path, but I digress. I just think that there's something to interviewing the individuals in the Cubensis cultivation industry that I admire greatly. And while Hamilton is not a cultivator of mushrooms per se, he is somebody who acutely understands the difficulty in accessibility for these products and the complete absurdity when it comes down to the prohibition of these quote-unquote illicit substances, which is just ridiculous at the end of the day. It's fucking foolhardy and absolutely absurd, and if you're on the side of the law, I can't fucking help you, you know? So, anyways, this is my attempt to bridge a gap. I hope you enjoy this episode. Go check out Hamilton Morris's podcast. I know you can get it for free on Spotify and shit, but not all of them are on there, and probably not all of them will be on there. I mean, he just interviewed one of the most gnarly dudes out there this past week that you'll just go check it out. So thank you, Hamilton. Thank you for being on Myco Wizards. And the rest of y'all, Myco Wizards of the world, I'm excited for what's up and coming. So keep an ear out for some varied characters on the podcast as we sort of dip into a combination of both psychedelic as well as gourmet and medicinal mushroom growers. Not straying from the path, just trying to bridge the motherfucking gap. All right, y'all. Have a wonderful rest of the week and raise some fucking holy hell. And if you haven't already, head over to capandstem.com, head over to mycowizards.com, give us a follow, subscribe, you know, all that jazz. I'd get beat up if I didn't say that, I guess. So don't put a gun on my head. Anyways, all right. Love you a long time, people. Goodbye. We're based out of Lewiston and Gardner, Maine. So, and I grew up in Lowell, Massachusetts, so not far from Boston area. Okay.
I'm familiar with Lowell. Yeah. Nice.
I'm sure you are. Maybe in the worst way. Well, yeah, once again, thanks for joining me, dude. Your podcast has been amazing and come out over the years, and I think a lot of the people we've been interviewing on Myco Wizards are directly connected with you in some way. And reaching out to Jason Slott to start a Stroma project was in direct relation to you. So I was like, why not reach out to Hamilton and see if you wanted to chat about just your history with mushrooms in general? And kind of, you've taken it from a very long, you know, sort of lineage of people who've been into this, but not well documented. And you've kind of surfaced some really cool stuff. And I don't know if you care to talk about those things in particular, but my early sort of inference of your work was when you did the truffle video in Amsterdam. That was the first time I think I had seen what you were up to. And I had the same time the Radical Mycology pamphlet that had just come out not too long before that. So, yeah, that was 2012, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I've always been interested in mushrooms. Psilocybin containing mushrooms were my first classical psychedelic experience. You know, as a child, I read Journey to the Mushroom Planet. I read a lot about mushrooms. I think mushrooms are just fascinating for any child that's generally interested in science. And they have this sort of mythological overlay that makes them maybe a little bit more mysterious than other organisms, or feel like they're connected to some kind of fantastical element. Same thing with Alice in Wonderland, obviously, as well. And Mario and everything else. So yeah, I was always interested in them. And had these amazing early experiences with psilocybin containing mushrooms, but then my interest sort of shifted mostly toward chemistry and synthetic compounds that are related to psilocin and psilocybin that are found in mushrooms. But you know, one thing that I was finding as I sort of focused on the synthesis side of things was that there were so many aspects of the underground history of psychedelics that had not been adequately documented out of fear, typically.
Right.
And so I was kind of thinking, wow, this is such a consequential aspect of the world and our culture. And yet there are tons of people with amazing stories about this stuff that have never even considered talking about it. Like, it's just completely secret. And yeah. And through a very, very bizarre series of events that I don't even fully understand myself, but my godfather went to college with Andrew Weil.
Okay.
And Andrew Weil is friends with Paul Stamets. True. And Paul Stamets, I think, had sent, I might be getting the details of this wrong, but I believe Paul Stamets had sent Andrew Weil this weird email that discussed the possibility that this guy, Stephen Pollock, had been murdered. And this email was sort of passed around, and it eventually my godfather sent it to me, and it had this very almost sensational tone, like the people like who were responsible for this are should be considered dangerous if they are still alive. Like, this was a murder, and there's a reason these people were never caught. And that was when I started really getting into the underground mushroom world, was sort of an effort to figure out who had killed this seminal mushroom researcher, Stephen Pollock.
Yeah, I'm familiar with him. Yeah. So is that the first time you had heard from him or heard about Stephen Pollock, was in that email?
Yeah, that was the first, because Stephen Pollock isn't really, I mean, this is one problem with being murdered, is it sort of takes right. you out of the discussion. So he's someone who was really very important. But because he, there was this period where you have McKenna, Stamets, Pollock, all publishing these little guides. And then there was another guy, Richard Gutierrez, and they're all publishing these guides. And so some of these people go on to become superstars, and some of them disappear completely. And the question is, why did some of them become superstars and why did some of them disappear? And what was interesting about Pollock is, at that time that he was doing this research, he was really very much on the same track as Andrew Weil. Because Andrew Weil is so prominent and successful and has so much crossover success. He's someone that, especially among kind of older hippie types, like,
yeah, everybody like weighs
boomer,
him in.
Like hippie boomer types.
He
his business is largely based on selling like elderly people supplements. That's like what, not even like weird supplements like N-acetylcysteine tablets. And so he became just immensely, immensely successful from essentially selling, vitamins and antioxidants to boomers. But if you go back to that same early period, Andrew Weil and Stephen Pollock are really on the same track. They're both on this, like, there's natural medicines out there, and maybe we should be investigating these natural medicines, and maybe these things are really the treatments that people need for this or that disorder. And maybe specifically psilocybin containing mushrooms are a very promising treatment modality for various ailments.
Andrew cultivate at all, or was that mostly, I know they had like a, if I remember directly from your, you wrote in Harper's that story about them, but I can't remember if they ever crossed paths, or did Andrew ever cultivate mushrooms?
Yeah. There's a photo of Andrew Weil in Pollock's house hanging out.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So they actually did know one another.
Oh yeah. Yeah. All these people were friends with one. I mean, the scene was really small then. Like, I don't know if you, there's sometimes photos of these conferences from the 80s, and it's like surreal, where it's like, wow, Rick Doblin, Alexander Shulgin, Albert Hoffman, Terrence McKenna, Andrew Weil are just like sit, and Jonathan Otter just like hanging out in a room together. It really does seem like everyone who was anyone was just in the same room. So it was a small world, and I don't think it's out of the question at all to think that Pollock, had he not been murdered, would have gone on to achieve Andrew Weil type success. Because he was really working with the same raw ingredients. He was a medical doctor. He was emphasizing the therapeutic effects of natural medicines. He was a little wackier, but being wacky has not hurt anyone. And
it's pretty normal.
It might even be an advantage and things like that. I just sort of became obsessed with that strange aspect of cultivation history, because there's so much early mushroom history that people really don't appreciate or take for granted. I mean, the most obvious thing being this fundamental transition from psilocybin containing mushrooms being considered so difficult to cultivate that it was out of the question. Like it just wasn't even an option to, like, there's a famous book, I don't know if you've seen this, called The Psychedelic Guide to the Preparation of the Eucharist. Do you know about this book?
Yeah. Oh, for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a beautiful, beautiful book. That's another thing I obsessed over and spent a long time trying to figure out who wrote it, and eventually tracked the guy down on his deathbed. But
who actually wrote it?
I don't know if I should say the guy's name. He's dead now. I'm going to release an interview with him eventually on my podcast. It like reconverges with a lot of other stuff, but that's an interesting story as well. But one of the things that I find sort of unintentionally historically funny about that book is he's describing these really complicated synthetic procedures, like synthesizing LSD. And he's saying, you know, first you need to turn on a red light, then an orange light for red light for the hydrolysis, then an orange light to create, you know, whatever, like lithium salt of lysergic acid, or I can't remember what exact method he was proposing. And then, you know, there's chromatography and all this stuff, and, you know, synthesis of mescaline. But when it comes to extracting mushrooms, he's just like, or growing mushrooms, he's like, impossible. Like, it can't be done. That's far too difficult. The best.
And that was published in like the 50s, I want to say.
Or? No, it's a bit later. I think it's probably 66, something like that.
Okay.
65. And that is really reflective of the state of knowledge at that time. This was just like, don't even try. So what he says in that book, the closest you could do is you could cultivate mycelium, and then you could extract the mycelium with methanol, and you could collect some psilocybin and psilocin that way. But don't even consider trying to fruit these things unless you're a, you know, academic mycologist, because it's just not going to be possible without a laboratory. So you have this, and you know, now in the United States, psilocybin containing mushrooms would be the most commonly consumed classical psychedelic drug. Whereas in the 1960s, this was like the rarest of the rare. It was easier to get peyote than it was to get psilocybin containing mushrooms. So the people that did try them, like Timothy Leary, they thought this is this exotic thing that you have to travel to Mexico if you want to. They didn't know that they grew it in the United States either. Another like really bizarre aspect of all of this.
In Mass and Maine, I mean, we have our own varieties.
Every state is
right. Yeah. Yeah.
It's incredible. Really kind of bizarre that these two things changed so fundamentally from being so rare you have to travel internationally to try it, and so difficult to cultivate that don't even try unless you're working in an academic mycological laboratory and you have a PhD in microbiology of some kind, to...
And then, along came Dennis McKenna and doing everything for everybody.
First psychedelic a high school student tries to produce, and the most widely consumed. And that, you know, that can largely be traced to, of course, the influence of Dennis McKenna. He's probably the main driver, but there were these auxiliary factors, people like Gutierrez and Pollock, who further disseminated techniques and sold kits and really did get this out and affect this fundamental change in the way mushrooms were understood by American culture.
Yeah, it's huge. It's hugely influential even now. And I think the dissemination between like the psychedelic growers and more along the lines of the work we do, which is all gourmets and the, you know, from cordyceps to shiitake, it's such a connection, and it's really hard to like tie those two together, except for the fact that, you know, that everybody who's involved in mushroom cultivation started, for the most part, until recent years, like the past 2-3 years, they started with psychedelics. And like, that's such a like huge, I was just interviewing Roger Rabbit, and he was talking about the, this 2016 was the last time he was at any event, and Guzman was there in his like suit and tie. Mm-hmm. It was like, it had to have been a year or two before he died maybe. Mm-hmm. And he said it was like the best experience of his life. Just like being like, look at this dude. Like, he's just down on his hands and knees picking like pan-sine essence or whatever out of alder chips. And it was somewhere in the Pacific Northwest, you know? It is just fascinating. These characters held so much weight for so long.
And, yeah, I mean, Guzman is so cool. He was.
Yeah, he was. Yeah.
I actually went to Veracruz to his lab.
Did you?
Yeah. To interview him before he died, obviously. And because after the Pollock story came out, I got a book deal to expand it into a book. And so I started doing more and more research and getting deeper into it, and went to Veracruz to spend time with Guzman. And he was such a character. I mean,
I bet.
Yeah.
Have you released that interview with him at all?
No, I haven't. It's funny. I should release it. I'll release it on my Patreon. The issue is that at that time, pretty much everyone that was doing interviews around that time only cared about whether or not you could hear what people were saying. Beyond that, audio quality was not a concern. So I have tons and tons of interviews that, from the perspective of I can understand the words that are being spoken, they're fine. But in terms of audio quality, it's going to unleash a tidal wave of irate comments. Do about it, I guess, until AI...
gets better.
You can just basically...
Has that been a primary concern for you, kind of moving away from Vice and onto your own sort of stuff? Because I've appreciated it. I followed your podcast and Patreon since you started it or started releasing those. And it was amazing to listen to like the audio difference between the interview you did with your dad, where you can hear that like, you know, on the mic, to like now, you know, and you're like, this, all right, he's figuring it out. Like, and it's sounding amazing and better all the time.
Yeah.
Is that, you think that's important for your...
Doing horrible.
No, you're good, man.
Yeah. Well, because I guess I never have really listened to podcasts, and I don't think I even understood podcasts until very recently. Well, what I think is going on is that for many people, podcasts are almost functioning like a drug, and they want to have a sort of escapist, dissociative type experience where they're completely immersed in this conversation. And audio quality, because I would think, why does everyone, suddenly everyone's an audiophile who has a like a episode of
strong ear of, for the perfect of mic.
Rage if they hear the tiniest sound from somebody's mouth, and I consider myself a very irritable person. You know, like I keep earplugs in my pocket almost all the time because if I'm ever, you know, in a library or on the train, everyone is like slurping liquid from the tiny amount of interstitial liquid from a cup of ice or doing some kind of impossibly inconsiderate, annoying thing. And, and so, but even by my standards, you know, somebody's mouth making a tiny sound is just not something I would ever complain about or, or something like that. But then I realized, holy shit, people really do not like a little mouth sound. Like,
well, it's amazing. The spectrum is all over. I was just in New York for that Harry Smith exhibit. I don't know if you got a chance to see that at the Whitney. But
no, I don't even know what is that.
So Harry Smith was, he did the, he's most known for his collection of, American folk music, that Folkways put out like in the '50s. And he was an artist in New York City forever and a really sort of curmudgeon-y character, super into psychedelics and strange stuff and recording music. And he recorded endless and endless hours of field recordings. And you should check that show out if it hasn't closed down yet. They're going to do it in Boston as well, in, I think, the next year. And you listen – so I went there to basically talk to Chuck Stein and a few different people from a previous life of mine outside of mushrooms. And we just sat there for hours listening to field recordings of Harry Smith, where he just, like, sat in Central Park with a boom mic and just recorded himself like smoking cigarettes and listening to birds, you know? And it was like the most amazing thing to be in a group of like 300 people, just listening to somebody who in 1974 was just like recording sounds, you know?
It's,
so there's that spectrum. And then there's if there's heavily talking, it becomes this like really annoying internal struggle for people sometimes. But, you know, I think there is an addiction, like a side of, there's this addiction component to this, but most of the people who listen to Myco Wizards, they're people who are working in front of a laminar flow hood all day. And they're quite literally just like, they're making spawn, they're making cultures. The only reason we continue doing this podcast is because the following behind it is solely those people who are driving it forward. And they're the ones who are just monotonously like transferring agar, like working in front of some sort of loud, sterile technique workspace with a Tyvek filter suit on. And they just need something to like engage with outside of their norm. So it's almost like a comfort too for some people. And I didn't know that about podcasting in general. So it's become kind of weird to like investigate it, as you're saying.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, the thing that people always talk about is the parasocial aspect of it, where there's sort of like a friendship simulation dimension. And, and so I really started to understand that, where I was like, you know, spending time with my family and listening to podcasts. And I was like, oh yeah, this, the point here is that it's taking you out of where you are. And if it's bad audio quality, that drug like dissociative dimension of the podcast is reduced. And then it becomes more purely informational, which is what the only reason I was ever interested in podcasts to begin with. So this is like, I think I'm starting to get it now.
Yeah. Sure.
Yeah.
That makes sense to lean into it. Yeah. Okay, so you worked from sort of this Pollock angle and you wrote, like, quite honestly, that could be turned into a book. It's one of the longest articles of psychedelic history that's really, really well written. So congratulations on however the fuck you assembled that over X amount of time, because that's a beautiful piece of writing. And going from that, you sort of dip further into people like Gutierrez and Yoshin Gard and people who are kind of a little more esoteric than even Pollock himself.
Yeah. 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 I mean, I think that one thing I've really discovered is that if you just are curious about something, if something seems historically weird to you, the chances are that there's something interesting going on that's worth investigating. And I have been consistently rewarded in having simple curiosity about these sorts of things. Like, there's almost always a good story behind all these different things. And, you know, there's kind of an infinite list of weird things to investigate and figure out what was really going on, how they came to be the way they were. You know, I really want to do an episode dedicated to the Enigma strain, or what cultivar, or whatever the appropriate classification of that would be. Because that is morphologically such a, yeah, it's such an amazing thing.
What do you find interesting about it, other than like the obvious like mutative forms that it takes?
Well, that and the idea that by mutating the fungus, you can also achieve these very high alkaloid concentrations that, I at least according to Alan Rockefeller, are maybe a simple result of slowing down growth, so that there's more time for psilocin and psilocybin biosynthesis and accumulation in the tissues. But you know, I think that there's still so much room for radically changing these organisms, and that we're really just at the beginning of all of this, because a really fundamental dimension of selective breeding of any kind, if you're doing it out of interest in the phytochemistry or mycochemistry of an organism, is having access to analytical instruments. You know, cannabis is really extraordinary in that it's sort of a rare example of an organism where you can visually estimate the concentration of active principle just on the superficial appearance of the plant. So you can look at cannabis and say, oh yeah, look at this, is just covered in resin. It's glistening. The trichomes are very active. And based on that, you can make an educated guess. Yeah, this is probably going to be pretty potent. And you can also, of course, smoke it and get a very quick assessment of whether or not you've created something that's very potent, and use that to inform selective breeding. But that is not the case for many other organisms, like peyote, for example. You know, you have a very, very slow growth cycle. The time from seed germination to the production of the first flower can easily be a decade. Under kind of, I won't say ideal circumstances, because, you know, using grafting and a million other things, you can probably cut it down to 5 years or something like that. But I would say in nature, it's probably over a decade. And then on top of that, you have this, so then you're finally at a point where you can, you know, reproduce the genetics of that particular organism. But how are you even going to know whether or not that plant has a high concentration of mescaline or a low concentration of mescaline? It's much, much more difficult. It's not like cannabis. And so nobody has ever been able to do any kind of selective breeding with any mescaline-containing cacti. That for aesthetic purposes they have, because what is visually pleasing is easy to analyze. But when it comes to the chemistry, there's nothing you can look at really and say, oh yeah, yeah, that's a high mescaline phenotype right there, without access to analytical instruments. So now that there's been a gradual change in drug policy, where there are these places in California or Massachusetts and more licensed laboratories where people can actually start testing plants and fungi, it makes that sort of selective breeding and the identification of promising or interesting genetic anomalies of one kind or another much easier to identify. And this is going to really rapidly transform a lot of these organisms in a way that's similar to what happened with cannabis, where you have these, you know, radical chemical alterations relative to the wild type.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot of people too with really small laboratories. Like, I'm talking to a guy later today, if you know him, Julian Matucci.
No.
He's Instagram land. He's like de-dicheratization daddy. And, what's interesting about him is he's the first person to really make a obsessive inquiry into dedicheratization, which is obviously like splitting a dikaryotic mushroom into its two monokaryotic constituents, and then running DNA analysis further past barcode DNA sequencing, but more into full genome sequencing and actually discovering kind of where these things originate from, because that's kind of the interesting prospect of mushrooms is you can peel them apart because of their like coincidic existence or their formation. You're able to really like see where these things come from. That's how they figured out. It's weird. Have you ever eaten or seen black oyster or shima furi hiritaki, which is just like a normal?
No, I don't think so.
It's grown by so many gourmet mushroom farms now. And the originators were Hokuto Kanoko, which they have a spot in California, but they're a Japanese company. And what they did to get this, like everybody calls it a king oyster, blue oyster cross, is they actually had to cross a European oyster and a variant of a king oyster that everybody calls Nebradini. And then they crossed two other variants of king oyster together, and through a series of about 11 crosses came up with an ability in a way in which you can mate a Pleurotus austriatus and a Pleurotus orangi and actually formulate these connections to create something that is actually completely different looking morphologically. So you couldn't do that before Hokuto Kanoko figured it out and developed a process patent. And it was amazingly difficult to find that patent because they didn't call it anything that they marketed as, you know. So I found the patent and then I was like, okay, this is interesting. So talking to this de-dicharitization guy, he wrote a simple protocol for tearing these dikaryotic mushrooms apart and then disseminating what's in them. But luckily with Enigma, you know, that folklore is like all existent on the shroomery. You can really see like who was participating and taking tidal wave and crossing it with something. But it is a fascinating thing. So you're going to go down the rabbit hole of trying to like find the characters who are basically doing that work.
Yeah, I've been working on that for a while, trying to do an episode that's dedicated to that particular history because, I think it's really second only to penis envy in terms of a really interesting and chemically consequential modification of Psilocybe cubensis.
Yeah. Yeah. Which is like, I mean, that was the only one for the longest time. Do you still keep up with any of these people like Richard Gutierrez?
Yeah. I mean, just over email occasionally. I wanted to, I have been meaning to write to him actually, because, you know, the kind of one of the interesting aspects of his history is that he was doing this work for this, geneticist who later won a Nobel Prize. And, I think that he would be very happy to know that penis envy was the first psilocybin containing mushroom that had its entire, I mean, I understand that it's cubensis, but it was specifically the penis envy cubensis that had its entire genome sequence. So I thought that he would be excited to learn that. So I've been meaning to show him that for a while.
Oh, yeah, because you're referring to Jason's work in his sort of horizontal gene transfer stuff.
I don't know if it was, he may have been a co-author. I'm trying to remember whose paper it was. The paper doesn't say penis envy, I don't think. It might say like something. It doesn't, it's not, certainly not in the title. It's not like, you know, full genome sequencing.
Go figure.
Penis envy cubensis.
Yeah, that would be really interesting. I mean, it's kind of, it's a wild thing to consider who was there and when. And just the way in which people are going wild with it now. You speak of Alan Rockefeller, and when I was at the OP Fungi Fest with Mark Keith and him, it was like the first time that those two had ever interacted outside of the shroomery, and it was the most like bizarre experience to see them like come up on one another like old Western film sort of thing, and then they realized who one another were, and then they began this weird kind of interaction and dance where they referenced somebody who Mark had bailed out of jail in like the early 90s or mid 2000s, I want to say. And the rest of us are just standing around like we have no idea what they're talking about, you know. But a lot of those people who were, you know, persistent in the shroomery for a long time, they know things that none of us do. So there's immense amount of stories and gratification and sort of uncovering and archiving that. So it's a huge driver, I think, for people like yourself who are kind of interested in the journalistic side of these things.
Yeah. There's so many weird aspects of this history.
So are you still doing chemistry work in Philadelphia? I kind of understood where you were doing and working was with a chemistry lab down there to basically study psychedelic constituents and such.
Yeah. I spent years making new psychedelic drugs at this small lab at an old pharmacy school in Philadelphia. And yeah. I'm trying to move the research to a different lab at the moment, but yeah, it was an interesting thing, and we discovered a lot of new 2A agonists. I mean,
wow.
Again, this is just, it's like so many other aspects of this sort of research where there's still a lot of low-hanging fruit. There's a lot of basic stuff that people like Alexander Shulgin gestured toward that simply no one had done. It wasn't there was any kind of major technical barrier that we didn't have the synthetic technology to do it. There was just a lot of stuff that there were so few people working on these problems and in this area that really simple things had just not been examined. You know, like one, P-call and T-call are riddled with these tantalizing leads that Shulgin intentionally left. You know, he really was an inspiring person in so many different ways. But one of them was that he took great pride in promoting curiosity about these things. He didn't feel the need to kind of, you know, say like, I'm the person that discovered everything. Like the book is full of these things. Like I didn't have time to do this, but you should do it. Here's a cool little thing. Someone needs to figure this out. What about 5-bromo-DMT?
He's a professor at heart, right? Like he's trying to feed into the narratives of intelligent students and future generations of chemists. And he did it well.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause I think he really understood that in order to affect the sort of change that would be necessary, it would require many people studying these sorts of things, and that he was just one man. And I really do think that that was one of the fundamental things that those books accomplished, was just inspiring huge numbers of people to get interested and see what else was out there. We definitely discovered a lot of interesting things, and
that's great, man. How does that inform what you're doing with the podcast and where you kind of want to take that?
I mean, I think that having had, 14, 15 years of experience synthesizing various psychedelics has certainly been very useful in my own understanding, because I think that's another aspect of this history, is you often would not, either people would never talk about work done in underground labs, and if you would learn about it, it would be some kind of post-mortem analysis by law enforcement, and so the real story would never get, or some kind of horrible journalists that not only knew nothing about science or chemistry, but maybe even had some kind of anti-drug agenda. I was just researching this this interesting story because I was kind of interested in this legal question about, because you know, the DEA has just been, they continue to prohibit enormous numbers of drugs. Like, this is, people talk about prohibition as if it's some kind of past tense thing. Yeah. Like, oh yeah, this, you know, this stupid thing we did in the 1970s, and now we've got to correct that mistake from back then. But the reality, of course, is that this is an ongoing mistake that is not in the past tense. And not only do we have to correct all of the stupidity of the Controlled Substances Act, but new drugs are continuously being prohibited. And many people, including people who at least present themselves as caring about these issues, don't really do anything about it when a new drug is on the chopping block. And there was an interesting one recently called ethylphenidate. And this is just, you know, a very obscure methylphenidate slash Ritalin type thing that was never a public health issue.
Concern.
Like something yeah. almost no one has ever even heard of. But I thought it presented a really interesting legal dilemma because this is actually produced unintentionally anytime somebody who consumes Ritalin drinks alcohol. So, you know, Ritalin is one of the most prescribed drugs in the world. And a lot of people drink alcohol. So that means that a lot of people are going to be manufacturing this drug that is slated to become a Schedule I controlled substance. So my question was, is that a crime? Is it, if you produce a Schedule I controlled substance accidentally, is that a legal defense? I mean, I imagine they're not going to be going after people and, you know, testing their blood to see that they've done this.
Just even I mean, on a, maybe, right.
Well, yeah, I mean, it is an interesting question. And so I started trying to look for any kind of case law associated with this question of people who had accidentally synthesized controlled substances and whether intent is a necessary part of the law in this instance. And I believe that it actually is, interestingly. So I do think that they have to demonstrate intent. And you could, so unless you intended to make the ethylphenidate, I don't think that they could secure a conviction. I've asked a couple lawyers about this, and this is what they've led me to believe. So then I started looking for instances of people who had accidentally produced controlled substances. And there's a
within
really,
their own biome.
What is that?
Within their own biome, essentially.
Well, there's a really funny one, actually, that happened in the UK, where there was this chemist who claimed to have accidentally synthesized MDMA. And his legal defense was a synthetically plausible mistake. Like, it is possible that he claimed that he had a malfunctioning manometer and that he thought a reaction had gone one way. He thought that he had attempted to isomerize safrole to isosafrole, but it didn't work. So he thought that he was, in fact, oxidizing safrole when he was really oxidizing isosafrole, but he didn't know that because of the malfunctioning manometer. So, and so he made kilos of MDMA accidentally. And, and you know, there's a couple sort of forensic chemistry articles outlining, he got away with it, which is really cool.
That's amazing. And, you know, these like recipes for like how you get out of certain situations as a sort of a clandestine character in these environments. Do you write a book that says this is how you can get away with this? You know, is what you should say if you ever get arrested. It's like the lawyer card just says shut the fuck up. You know,
and so, you know, guaranteed there's a story there. You know, this is one of those things I've been trying to track this guy down unsuccessfully, but, you know, this is just one of those things where, you know, this guy probably felt like he got away with murder. I mean, of course, he should not have been in legal trouble for doing this to begin with, but it's not the sort of thing that he's going to be eager to say, oh, yeah, can you believe I got away with that? The malfunctioning manometer line actually was sufficient to get me off of this.
That's wild.
But, you know, there's a story there, and that's the story that this guy, you know, probably would have never wanted to tell anyone. Maybe he'll tell me if I'm able to track him down, but that's just another one of these examples where it's like, there's a definitely a different story than the one that was presented to the court and analyzed in these forensic chemistry journals. And the question is, can you figure out what was actually going on here?
Right. I like how these stories are the driver for you. Like they're do you think it's just from an archival sense, is trying to create some historical narrative for the future to sort of look back at, or what drives you to like get these stories?
I mean, you know, it really, I think, is necessary for understanding these very basic aspects of how the world is the way that it is. You know, once you start looking into these things, it really does start to answer basic questions about why one drug as opposed to another drug circulates and why the history of our cultures have moved one way or another way. And a lot of it comes down to these really strange little things. You know, why was MDMA MDMA and not MDA, and what sorts of factors were involved with the ascent of LSD or this or that research chemical. And you know, it's often these sort of small influences that can have a really, really big effect on our culture. You know, another example would be something like the possibility that the apartheid government in South Africa was playing a calculated role in the distribution of mandrax / quaalude / methaqualone. I mean, they were definitely manufacturing it. That's, they have acknowledged that themselves, and manufacturing a lot of it. And it seems pretty clear that they were distributing it. So the question is, to what extent did that influence the culture in South Africa? And you know, you run into similar things with MK Ultra. You know, I think people sometimes exaggerate the influence of things as well. So it can go in both directions, where people start to think that the entire counterculture was some kind of calculated psyop, which if it was, I don't think it was particularly successful.
It's mostly accidental, it seems like, right?
Well, you know, this, like, the claim that people will make is some version of, you know, if people could be engaged in some kind of masturbatory spiritual exploration as opposed to direct political action, then this would ultimately hobble the counterculture, the anti-war movement. But I really just think that there's a stronger case to be made for the idea that psychedelics were a major impetus behind the anti-war movement and a lot of political activism. Like, I don't doubt that in some instances it resulted in people sort of withdrawing within themselves to engage in some kind of isolated spiritual pursuit and not build politically active communities. But I don't know. I don't think that the argument for that is very strong.
Yeah. It's really hard to say. It's hard to get these like ley lines even right now with the the psilocybin boom that's happening. Like, I persist and live in I don't grow psychedelic mushrooms anymore at all. I just supply farms all across the country that do gourmet stuff and with spawn and substrate and equipment and such, but I'm surrounded by the characters that grow psychedelics, and they do it either really like blatantly and out in the open with this sort of weird God complex or not, or just balls. Or there's the characters who are like extremely careful and they do not talk to anybody about what they do. And watching the price of psychedelics, or specifically psilocybin, drop like over the course of the last year and a half and go down to like $75 a pound back. I mean, you can buy shiitakes for $75 a dried pound. So you're bringing it down to a commodity crop like on the West Coast. And then on the East Coast, you have, you know, there's a dude who we were supplying some substrate to who got busted in Connecticut with, I don't know how many pounds of dried cubensis. And we were just supplying him with grain spawn, your grain blanks. But it's amazing to sort of see this thing that people are charging towards and there's no money in it. And why are they continuing to do it and sort of like persist in it from a illegality standpoint? I don't know if you're experiencing that too in talking to some of these sort of outlaw, you know, mycologist characters.
I've heard that has been happening, and that's, you know, I think a sort of inevitable result of the popularization of anything, especially something that is a crop that can be grown, is that more has obviously happened with cannabis in a big way.
Yeah.
More people will want it. The demand increases and then the supply increases to meet the increased demand, and the price goes down with increased supply, and something that was once very expensive becomes extremely cheap. And you know, I don't think that there's anything necessarily wrong with that. It's certainly good for the consumer.
Yeah. Yeah, it just makes it a challenge, I guess, for the industry that was there. Like, you can imagine Pollock, you know, starting to construct and build this monolith to, like, you know, his Tampanese, and then realize that that stuff is, like, happening all around us and they're crumbling, like, all the time. Like, you have these mega, you know, large mushroom farms, whether they're cubensis or regular mushrooms, and they're just shutting down all the time now. And it's happening in Europe, it's happening in the Far East, and it's happening in the States. And pretty religiously every week, it seems like the bigger you are, if you don't have a quick pivot, you fall really fast. And, you know, maybe that's just normal, but with any industry, but it's interesting to see it in such a booming aspect of, like, what mushrooms are right now to people, whether they're psychedelic or gourmet or otherwise.
Yeah. But, yeah. And I mean, I think with the gourmet mushrooms, I think it's a good thing because they are expensive for most people, but they're probably too expensive for most people. Especially because most people are not from a culture that has, you know, a really good way of consuming them. Like, you know, obviously there's a long heritage in a lot of Asian cultures of using mushrooms. But, you know, if I go to a farmer's market and there's have a dozen different species, I'm kind of like, okay, I'll get some lion's mane and I'll get some enoki and I'll get some oysters and I guess I'll just make a stew with all of this stuff. And it costs, you know, it's actually pretty expensive. And I'm mostly doing it because I really like the flavor of them and think that they're good, but I'm also in the back of my head thinking, you know, maybe this will confer some kind of desirable health effect as well.
Right. That's the hope.
Yeah. Yeah. So, but that's expensive for, I think, you know, for, especially because the caloric value of a mushroom is going to be pretty low. So it's, you know, if you're worrying about feeding yourself and you don't have a lot of money, using these sorts of mushrooms as a food source, at least in most American cities, is not really financially accessible to a lot of people. So if the price goes down, I think it will ultimately be a good thing and more people can really start to integrate mushrooms into the foods that they eat more commonly. I think it will ultimately be very beneficial because there's so many delicious mushrooms. I mean, the most obvious example would be morels that really the only reason that people are not consuming them more frequently is cost and a lack of availability. But like even commercially, like it was a Domino's, I think, that was working on a project to have a morel pizza. And
They bought the patent for morel production from Gary Mills, who coincidentally is involved. He's the guy who started, I forget the name of his business, but Mycotopia bought him out. One of the bigger like bottle farms bought that guy out. But there's some murder mystery there, like where his business partner was murdered and he developed the patent for this tray-based morel production. And then Domino's bought the patent from him or something?
Yeah, there was a morel murder as well, yeah. I mean, there's so much weird stuff. I mean, you know, there's
mushroom murders.
Like there's a whole conspiracy type idea that this is not accidental and that there's a kind of organized crime dimension to the monopoly of the Agaricus bisporus and they're trying to maintain this white button status quo and preventing the public from accessing these more delicious species, which, you know, it really is a shame because I'm sure a morel pizza would be really, really delicious. Good. And this is like such a, I mean, I guess there's analogous things that even happen with fruit. Like, there's so many delicious types of fruit that people in the United States don't have access to. Like a cherimoya would be the major example where it's like, this is just kind of insane to me that in this like hyper consumerist culture where everyone is trying to, you know, sell various superfoods or whatever, that like one of the most delicious types of fruit on the planet is basically inaccessible to most people in the United States.
I mean, you're from the East Coast. Like, the first time you went to the West Coast, were you blown away by how cheap avocados are and you could actually, like, afford to make guacamole?
Yeah.
That blew my mind, you know?
Yeah. Well, I mean, the avocado situation is...
Yeah,
especially weird.
It is very strange. it's pretty crazy. Have you? And this sort of like off topic in a weird way, but not really. You're talking about a lot of these characters and like the inferences of their roles and bigger pictures. But have you talked to Leonard Picard at all ever since he was released from jail?
Oh yeah, yeah. I've talked to him a lot. Yeah.
Yeah. What is his deal now? Is he sort of like in a realm of trying to? I mean, I don't know how a dude that age and who's gone through what he's gone through has kind of readjusted to life. I haven't really thought about it since he sort of did a few interviews with people, but.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's difficult. It's if I know young people who were in prison for relatively short periods of time. I mean, still very long. And those people often have lasting difficulty with readjustment. And I think the other aspect that is probably psychologically difficult for him is that he was released under these extraordinary circumstances. Of course, he should have been released. It was the right thing to release him, but it wasn't as if his conviction was overturned due to some kind of, you know, new evidence that was presented or anything like that. So I think that there's this looming sense that he has of, you know, I got out for these sort of unclear reasons. Like I have to be extra careful because maybe they could just put me back just as easily as they let me out.
That's what it sounded like from a few interviews that I heard when he first got out. He was like, I can't really talk on the topic, you know? And I was like, well, I have so many questions, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I think he's, and I can completely understand why, you know, if I were in that position, I'm sure I'd be exactly the same way. It just seems like, I think he's probably just so happy to be free. And from everything I can tell, he just is really, reveling in the freedom that he has. And I'm so happy for him that he is getting this justice that he deserved. I mean, it doesn't take away the fact that he lost so much of his life in prison, but it's really.
Did you look into like the course of what happened? Because all I think most people know is it's just COVID and they just released him. They're like, don't die in prison. We're overwhelmed. Get out of here.
Yeah. I mean, I think with nonviolent offenders, they liberalized the rules for compassionate release during COVID. And I don't know the exact factors that went into his release, but it was certainly the right thing to do. I mean, it's just insane that they were ever thinking that that was an inappropriate sentence for, I mean, I don't even consider it a crime at all. You know, you shouldn't have been in prison for any amount of time, let alone a life sentence. It's just absurd. He was, you know, doing, I think, a service to people.
Yeah. 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 I feel a lot of that about the characters that I know who've been in and out of jail or just skipped it narrowly. They're just people who I couldn't imagine in a million years being stuck in a cell all day. And it's like, it's a hard reality check when you really care about something that is considered illicit, you know, by the government you're under, and you know, you're risking everything basically to do what you believe in. And that's a hard bet. It's, I don't know. It's why I got out of growing, you know, psychedelics. I'm still tangent to it. Like, I really do appreciate those people and I love reading about it and, you know, eating mushrooms from time to time, but like, yeah, to go into the extent that some people are right now, I just wouldn't do it personally. So I get that fear.
Yeah.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. What else? What's next for you? Are you just going to keep cranking on the podcast or you have other big plans in the works?
Yeah. Yeah. I'm working on several different things simultaneously. The podcast is nice because it's sort of bite-sized pieces that I can release periodically, where some of these bigger things are just taking forever, as bigger things tend to. And but yeah, I've been working on a film project and working on science things and working on other written pieces as well. So I always have a lot of stuff that I'm working on, but the podcast is nice because it's a way of continuing to release stuff while working on these things that often end up taking years to actually complete.
Yeah, these projects are unreal. I definitely remember hearing you talk about just getting Hamilton's Pharmacopoeia finished up for that last season during COVID. Like, I don't know anybody else who pulled stuff off like that. So hats off to you, man.
Yeah. And it required a whole team of people working together. I mean, it was really, it should have been difficult, but it was even more difficult than it should have been. It was just absurd how hard that was.
Yeah, I bet. I can't even imagine, man. Yep. Well, that's great. Well, I won't take up more than an hour of your time, man. I really appreciate you coming on here and chatting mushrooms with you, man.
Of course. Yeah, it was a pleasure.
Yeah. Stay in touch and keep doing what you're doing. I'm all about the podcast. It's great.
Okay. Have a good day. Good talking.
Hey, you too, Hamilton. Cheers. What did you think of that episode? If you want more of this Myco wizardry, stay tuned because we are turning up the heat. We are shooting for a release a week on MycoWizards.com and a release a week on Spotify, Apple, iTunes, Slinger, Stitcher, Bewitcher, really, you know, wherever the fuck you get your podcast. So be on the lookout for that ear candy because it's coming your way. This podcast is produced and sponsored by Main Cap and Stem. Need cultures, spawn, substrate, equipment, raw materials, consultations? Reach on out to the amazing team of Cap and Stem at www.capnstem.com. If you want to support this podcast, swing on over to MycoWizards.com and become a member of the largest culture bank on the fucking planet. Seriously, our team is focused on bringing you commercial, gourmet, and experimental cultures from around the globe. So become a member of our culture club at MycoWizards.com today. Don't dig the flow hood work? That's okay. Come on in for the videos, the deep dives, the exclusive interviews, and pheno flicks. Yeah, that's what we're calling them. Motion picture flicks focused on the phenotypes we are working with every day. Don't want videos? Don't dig the fungus on dishes? Just want to support this podcast? Well, shit, you can do that too for $5 a month to keep this show on the road. Speaking of the road, I have to send a special thanks to the new and improved and magical and mysterious Myco Wizards team consisting of Mr. Michael Vance, Dr. Daniel Ashley, as well as Tyler Crawford and the Flowhood man, Sir Gregor Jones. Okay, I'm Eric Lohman. Stay weird, my Myco Wizard family, and hopefully we'll see you out there in hyperspace. I like that effect.